coiled as it was around the length of turtle-shaped space-time known as the Discworld, the story shook. One broken end flapped loose and flailed through the night, trying to find any sequence to feed on. In the clearing, the trees moved. So did the shadows. Shadows shouldn't be able to move unless the light moves. These did. The drumming stopped. In the silence, there was the occasional sizzle as power cracked across the hanging coat. Saturday stepped forward. Green sparks flew out to his hands as he gripped the jacket and put it on. His body jerked. Erzulia Goggle breathed out.
"You are here," she said. "You are still yourself. You are exactly yourself."
Saturday raised his hands with his fists clenched. Occasionally an arm or leg would jerk as the power inside him squirrel-caged around in its search for freedom. But she could see that he was riding it.
"It will become easier," she said, more gently now.
Saturday nodded. With the power flowing inside him, he had, she thought, the fire he'd had when he was alive. He'd not been a particularly good man, she knew. Genua had not been a model of civic virtue, but at least he'd never told people that they wanted him to oppress them, and that everything he did was for their own good. Around the circle, the people of New Genua, the old New Genua, knelt or bowed. He hadn't been a kind ruler, but he'd fitted. And when he'd been arbitrary or arrogant or just plain wrong, he'd never suggested that this was justified by anything other than the fact that he was bigger and stronger and occasionally nastier than other people. He'd never suggested that it was because he was better. And he'd never told people they ought to be happy and imposed a kind of happiness on them. The invisible people knew that happiness is not the natural state of mankind and is never achieved from the outside in. Saturday nodded again, this time in satisfaction. When he opened his mouth, sparks flashed between his teeth, and when he waded through the swamp, the alligators fought to get out of his way. It was quiet in the palace kitchens now. The huge trays of roast meat, the pigs' heads with apples in their mouths, the multi-layered trifles had long ago been carried upstairs. There was a clattering from the giant sinks at the far end, where some of the maids were making a start on the washing up. Mrs. Pleasant, the cook, had made herself a plate of red stripe fish in crawfish sauce. She wasn't the finest cook in Genua. No one got near Mrs. Goggle's gumbo. People would almost come back from the dead for a taste of Mrs. Goggle's gumbo. But the comparison was as narrow as that between, say, diamonds and sapphires. She'd done her best to cook up a good banquet because she had her professional pride, but there wasn't much she felt she was able to do with lumps of meat. Genuine cooking, like the best cooking everywhere in the multiverse, had been evolved by people who had to make desperate use of ingredients their masters didn't want. No one would even try a bird's nest unless they had to. Only hunger would make a man taste his first alligator. No one would eat a shark's fin if they were allowed to eat the rest of the shark. She poured herself a rum and was just picking up the spoon when she felt herself being watched. A large man in a black leather doublet was staring at her from the doorway, dangling a ginger cat mask from one hand. It was a very direct stare. Mrs. Pleasant found herself wishing she'd done something about her hair and was wearing a better dress.
"Yes," she said. "What do you want?"
"Want food, Mrs. Pleasant," said Gribo.
She looked him up and down. There were some odd types in Genua these days. This one must have been a guest at the ball, but there was something very familiar about him. Gribo wasn't a happy cat. People had made a fuss just because he'd dragged a roast turkey off the table. Then the skinny female with the teeth had kept simpering at him and saying she'd see him later in the rose garden, which wasn't at all the cat way of doing things, and that had got him confused, because this wasn't the right kind of body, and nor was hers. And there were too many other males around. Then he'd smelt the kitchen. Cats gravitate to kitchens like rocks gravitate to gravity.
"I seen you somewhere before," said Mrs. Pleasant.
Gribo said nothing. He'd followed his nose to a bowl on one of the big tables.
"Want?" he demanded.
"Fish heads," said Mrs. Pleasant.
They were technically garbage, although what she was planning with some rice and a few special sauces would turn them into the sort of dish kings fight for.
"Want,"
Gribo repeated. Mrs. Pleasant shrugged.
"You want raw fish heads, man? You take 'em," she said.
Gribeau lifted the bowl uncertainly. He wasn't too good with fingers. Then he looked around conspiratorially and ducked under the table. There were the sounds of keen gurgitation and the bowl being scraped around on the floor. Gribeau emerged.
"Milk?"
he suggested. Fascinated, Mrs. Pleasant reached for the milk jug and a cup.
"Saucer,"
Gribeau said. And a saucer. Gribeau took the saucer, gave it a long hard look, and put it on the floor. Mrs. Pleasant stared. Gribeau finished the milk, licking the remnant of his beard. He felt a lot better now. And there was a big fire over there. He padded over to it, sat down, spat on his paw, and made an attempt to clean his ears, which didn't work because inexplicably neither ears nor paw were the right shape, and then curled up as best he could, which wasn't very well, given that he seemed to have the wrong sort of backbone, too. After a while, Mrs. Pleasant heard a low, asthmatic rumble. Gribeau was trying to purr. He had the wrong kind of throat. In a minute, he was going to wake up in a bad temper and want to fight something. Mrs. Pleasant got on with her own supper. Despite the fact that a hulking great man had just eaten a bowl of fish heads and lapped a saucer of milk in front of her and was now stretched out uncomfortably in front of the fire, she found she didn't feel the least bit afraid. In fact, she was fighting down an impulse to scratch his tummy. Magrat wrenched off the other slipper as she ran down the long red carpet towards the palace gateway and freedom. Just getting away, that was the important thing. From was more urgent than to. And then two figures drifted out of the shadows and faced her. She raised the slipper pathetically as they approached in absolute silence, but even in the twilight she could feel their gaze. The crowds parted. Lily Weatherwax glided through in a rustle of silk. She looked Granny up and down without any expression of surprise. "All in white, too," she said dryly. "My word, aren't you the nice one?"
"But I've stopped you," said Granny, still panting with the effort. "I've broken it."
Lily Weatherwax looked past her. The Snake Sisters were coming up the steps, holding a limp Magrat between them.
"Save us from people who think literally," said Lily. "The damn things come in pairs, you know."
She crossed to Magrat and snatched the second slipper out of her hand.
"The clock was interesting," she said, turning back to Granny. "I was impressed with the clock. But it's no good, you know. You can't stop this sort of thing. It has the momentum of inevitability. You can't spoil a good story. I should know."
She handed the slipper to the prince, but without taking her eyes off Granny.
"It'll fit her," she said.
Two of the courtiers held Magrat's leg as the prince wrestled the slipper past her protesting toes.
"There," said Lily, still without looking down, "and do stop trying that hedge witch hypnotism on me, Esme."
"It fits," said the prince, but in a doubtful tone of voice.
"Yes, anything would fit," said a cheerful voice from somewhere towards the back of the crowd, "if you were allowed to put two pairs of hairy socks on first."
Lily looked down. Then she looked at Magrat's mask. She reached out and pulled it off.
"Ow!"
"Wrong girl," said Lily. "But it still doesn't matter, Esme, because it is the right slipper, so all we have to do is find the girl whose foot it fits."
There was a commotion at the back of the crowd. Courtiers parted, revealing Nanny Ogg, oil-covered and hung with spiderwebs.
"If it's a 5½ narrow fit, I'm your man," she said. "Just let me get these boots off."
"I wasn't referring to you, old woman," said Lily, coldly.
"Oh, yes, you was," said Nanny. "We know how this bit goes, see? The prince goes all round the city with the slipper, trying to find the girl whose foot fits. That's what you was planning, so I can save you a bit of trouble. How about it?"
There was a flicker of uncertainty in Lily's expression.
"A girl," she said, "of marriageable age."
"No problem there," said Nanny cheerfully.
The dwarf Casanunda nudged a courtier proudly in the knees.
"She's a very close personal friend of mine," he said proudly.
Lily looked at her sister.
"You're doing this. Don't think I don't know," she said.
"I ain't doing a thing," said Granny. "It's real life happening all by itself."
Nanny grabbed the slipper out of the prince's hands, and before anyone else could move, slid it onto her foot. Then she waggled the foot in the air. It was a perfect fit.
"There," she said. "See? You could have wasted the whole day."
"Especially because there must be hundreds of 5 1/2 narrow fit wearers in a city this size," Granny went on. "Unless, of course, you happen to sort of go to the right house right at the start. If you had, you know, a lucky guess."
"But that'd be cheating," said Nanny. She nudged the prince.
"I'd just like to add," she said, "that I don't mind doing all the waving and opening things and all the royal stuff, but I draw the line at sleeping in the same bed as Sonny Jim here."
"Because he doesn't sleep in a bed," said Granny.
"No, he sleeps in a pond," said Nanny. "We had a look. Just a great big indoor pond."
"Because he's a frog," said Granny.
"With flies all over the place in case he wakes up in the night and fancies his snack," said Nanny.
"I thought so," said Magrat, pulling herself out of the grip of the guards. "He had clammy hands."
"Lots of men have clammy hands," said Nanny, "but this one's got 'em because he's a frog."
"I'm a prince of blood royal," said the prince, "and a frog."
"I don't mind," said Casanunda from somewhere down below. "I enjoy open relationships. If you want to go out with a frog, it's fine by me."
Lily looked around at the crowd, then she snapped her fingers. Granny Weatherwax was aware of a sudden silence. Nanny Ogg looked up at the people on either side of her. She waved a hand in front of a guard's face.
"Cool," she said. "You can't do that for long," said Granny. "You can't stop 1,000 people for long."
Lily shrugged. "They're not important. Whoever will remember who was at the ball, they'll just remember the flight and the slipper and the happy ending."
"I've told you, you can't start it again, and he's a frog. Even you can't keep him in shape the whole day long. He turns back into his old shape at night. He's got a bedroom with a pond in it." "He's a frog," said Granny flatly.
"But only inside," said Lily.
"Inside's where it counts," said Granny.
"Outside's quite important, mind," said Nanny.
"Lots of people are animals inside. Lots of animals are people inside," said Lily. "Where's the harm?"
"He's a frog."
"Especially at night," said Nanny.
It had occurred to her that a husband who was a man all night and a frog all day might be almost acceptable. You wouldn't get the wage packet, but there'd be less wear and tear on the furniture. She also couldn't put out of her mind certain private speculations about the length of his tongue.
"And you killed the Baron," said Magrat.
"You think he was a particularly nice man?" said Lily. "Besides, he didn't show me any respect. If you've got no respect, you've got nothing."
Nanny and Magrat found themselves looking at Granny.
"He's a frog."
"I found him in the swamp," said Lily. "I could tell he was pretty bright. I needed someone amenable to persuasion. Shouldn't frogs have a chance? He'll be no worse a husband than many. Just one kiss from a princess seals the spell."
"A lot of men are animals," said Magrat, who'd picked up the idea from somewhere.
"Yes, but he's a frog."
"Look at it my way," said Lily. "You see this country? It's all swamps and fogs. There's no direction. But I can make this a great city. Not a sprawling place like Ankh-Morpork, but a place that works."
"The girl doesn't want to marry a frog."
"What will that matter in 100 years' time?"
"It matters now."
Lily threw up her hands. "What do you want, then? It's your choice. There's me, or there's that woman in the swamp. Light or dark, fog or sunshine, dark chaos or happy endings."
"He's a frog and you killed the old Baron," said Granny.
"You'd have done the same," said Lily.
"No," said Granny. "I'd have thought the same, but I wouldn't have done it."
"What difference does that make, deep down?"
"You mean you don't know?" said Nanny Ogg. Lily laughed.
"Look at the three of you," she said, "bursting with inefficient good intentions, the maiden, the mother and the crone."
"Who are you calling a maiden?" said Nanny Og.
"Who are you calling a mother?" said Magrat.
Granny Weatherwax glowered briefly like the person who has discovered that there is only one straw left, and everyone else has drawn a long one.
"Now, what shall I do with you?" said Lily. "I really am against killing people unless it's necessary, but I can't have you running around acting stupidly."
She looked at her fingernails.
"So I think I shall have you put away somewhere until this has run its course, and then... can you guess what I'm going to do next?"
"I'm going to expect you to escape, because after all, I am the good one." Ella walked cautiously through the moonlit swamp, following the strutting shape of Legba. She was aware of movement in the water, but nothing emerged. Bad news like Legba gets around, even among alligators. An orange light appeared in the distance. It turned out to be Mrs. Goggle's shack, or boat, or whatever it was. In the swamp, the difference between the water and the land was practically a matter of choice.
"Hello? Is anyone there?"
"Come along in, child. Take a seat. Rest up a little."
Ella stepped cautiously onto the rocking veranda. Mrs. Goggle was sitting in her chair, a white-clad raggedy doll in her lap.
Magrat said, "I know all about it. Come to Erzulia."
"Who are you?"
"I am your friend, girl."
Ella moved so as to be ready to run.
"You're not a godmother of any kind, are you?"
"No, no gods, just a friend. Did anyone follow you?"
Don't think so."
"It's no matter if they did, girl. No matter if they did. Maybe we ought to move out into the river for a spell, even so. We'll be a lot safer with water all around."
The shack lurched.
"You'd better sit down. The feet's make it shaky until we get into deep water."
Ella risked a look, nevertheless. Mrs. Goggle's hut travelled on four large duck feet, which were now rising out of the swamp. They splashed their way through the shallows and gently sculled out into the river. Gribo woke up and stretched. And the wrong sort of arms and legs. Mrs. Pleasant, who had been sitting watching him, put down her glass.
"What do you want to do now, Mr. Cat?" she said.
Gribo padded over to the door into the outside world and scratched at it.
"Want to go out, Mrs. Pleasant?" he said.
"You just have to turn the handle there," she said.
Gribo stared at the door handle like someone trying to come to terms with a piece of very advanced technology, and then gave her a pleading look. She opened the door for him, stood aside as he slunk out, and then shut it, locked it, and leaned against it.
"Ember's bound to be safe with Mrs. Goggle," said Magrat.
"Heh," said Granny. "I quite liked her," said Nanny Og. "I don't trust anyone who drinks rum and smokes a pipe," said Granny.
"Nanny Og smokes a pipe and drinks anything," Magrat pointed out.
"Yes, but that's because she's a disgusting old baggage," said Granny, without looking up.
Nanny Og took her pipe out of her mouth.
"That's right," she said amiably. "You ain't nothing if you don't maintain an image."
Granny looked up from the log.
"Can't shift it," she said. "It's Octoron too. Can't magic it open."
"It's daft, locking us up," said Nanny. "I'd have had us killed." "That's because you're basically good," said Magrat. "The good are innocent and create justice. The bad are guilty, which is why they invent mercy."
"Now I know why she's done this," said Granny darkly. "It's so's we'll know we've lost."
"But she said we'd escape," said Magrat. "I don't understand. She must know the good ones always win in the end."
"Only in stories," said Granny, examining the door hinges. "And she thinks she's in charge of the stories. She bends them round herself. She thinks she's the good one."
"Mind you," said Magrat, "I don't like swamps. If it wasn't for the fog and everything, I'd see Lily's point."
"Then you're nothing but a daft godmother," snapped Granny, still fiddling with the lock. "You can't go around building a better world for people. Only people can build a better world for people. Otherwise, it's just a cage." Besides, you don't build a better world by chopping heads off and giving decent girls away to frogs.
But progress, Magrat began.
Don't you talk to me about progress. Progress just means bad things happen faster. Anyone got another hat pin? This one's useless.
Nanny, who had Grebo's ability to make herself instantly at home wherever she happened to be, sat down in the corner of the cell. "I heard this story once," she said, "where this bloke got locked up for years and years, and he learned amazing stuff about the universe and everything from another prisoner who was incredibly clever, and then he escaped and got his revenge."
"What incredibly clever stuff do you know about the universe, Gither Og?" said Granny.
"Bugger all," said Nanny cheerfully.
"Then we'd better bloody well escape right now."
Nanny pulled a scrap of pasteboard out of her hat, found a scrap of pencil up there too, licked the end and thought for a while. Then she wrote, "Dear Jason, Untso Whiter, as they say in foreign parts. Well, here's a thing. Your old mum doing time in prison again. I'm an old lag. You'll have to send me a cake with a file in it, and I shall have little arrows on me clothes. Just my joke. This is a sketch of the dungeon. I'm putting a X where we are, which is inside. Magrat is shown wearing a posh dress. She has been acting like a courgette. Also, Ink, Esme getting fed up because she can't get the lock to work. But I expect it will all be okay because the good ones win in the end, and that's us. And all because some girl don't want to marry a prince who is a duck, who is really a frog. And I can't say I blame her. You don't want descendants who have got genes and start off living in a jam jar and then hop about and get squashed." She was interrupted by the sound of a mandolin being played quite, well, right on the other side of the wall, and a small but determined voice raised in song.
"Si consuenti d'amori, ventre di mo tondre turo."
"How I hunger, my love, for the dining room of your warm maceration," said Nanny without looking up.
"Della della toserento, odri tidren vontai."
The shop, I have a lozenge, the sky is pink," said Nanny. Granny and Magrat looked at one another.
"Guarunto teltari bellar pori di larientos."
"Rejoice, candlemaker, you have a great big..."
"I don't believe any of this," said Granny. "You're making it up."
"Word for word translation," said Nanny. "I can speak foreign like a native. You know that."
"Mrs. Og, is that you, my love?"
They all looked up towards the barred window. There was a small face peering in. "Cousin Under," said Nanny.
"That's me, Mrs. Og." "My love," muttered Granny.
"How did you get up to the window?" said Nanny, ignoring this.
"I always know where I can get my hands on a stepladder, Mrs. Og."
"I suppose you don't know where you can get your hands on a key."
"Wouldn't do any good. There's too many guards outside your door, Mrs. Og, even for a famous swordsman like me. Her ladyship gave strict orders. No one's to listen to you, or look at you even."
"How come you're in the palace guard, Cousin Under?"
"Soldier of fortune takes whatever jobs are going, Mrs. Og,"
said Cousin Under earnestly. "But all the rest of 'em are 6 foot tall, and you're of the shorter persuasion."
"I lied about my height, Mrs. Og. I'm a world-famous liar."
"Is that true?"
"No."
"What about you being the world's greatest lover?"
There was a silence for a while.
"Well, maybe I'm only number two," said Casanunda, "but I try harder."
"Can't you go and find us a file or something, Mr. Casanunda?" said Magrat.
"I'll see what I can do, miss."
The face disappeared.
"Maybe we could get people to visit us, and then we could escape in their clothes," said Nanny Og.
"Now I've gone and stuck the pin in my finger," muttered Granny Weatherwax.
"Or maybe we could get Magrat to seduce one of the guards," said Nanny.
"Why don't you?" said Magrat, as nastily as she could manage.
"All right, I'm game."
"Shut up, the pair of you," said Granny. "I'm trying to think."
There was another sound at the window.
It was Legba. The black cockerel peered in between the bars for a moment and then fluttered away.
"Gives me the creeps, that one," said Nanny. "Can't look at him without thinking wistfully of sage and onion and mashed potatoes."
Her crinkled face crinkled further.
"Grebo," she said, "where'd we leave him?"
"Oh, he's only a cat," said Granny Weatherwax. "Cats know how to look after themselves."
"He's really just a great big softy,"
Nanny began, before someone started pulling down the wall. A hole appeared. A grey hand appeared and grasped another stone. There was a strong smell of river mud. Rock crumbled under heavy fingers.
"Ladies," said a resonant voice.
"Well, Mr. Saturday," said Nanny. "As I live and breathe, saving your presence, of course."
Saturday grunted something and walked away. There was a hammering on the door and someone started fumbling with the keys.
"We don't want to hang around here," said Granny. "Come on."
They helped one another out through the hole. Saturday was on the other side of a small courtyard, striding towards the sound of the ball. And there was something behind him, trailing out like the tail of a comet.
"What's that?" "Mrs. Goggles doing," said Granny Weatherwax grimly.
Behind Saturday, widening as it snaked through the palace grounds to the gate, was a stream of deeper darkness in the air. At first sight, it seemed to contain shapes, but closer inspection indicated that they weren't shapes at all, but a mere suggestion of shapes, forming and reforming. Eyes gleamed momentarily in the swirl. There was the chittering of crickets, and the whine of mosquitoes, the smell of moss, and the stink of river mud.
"It's the swamp," said Magrat.
"It's the idea of the swamp," said Granny. "It's what you have to have first before you have the swamp."
"Oh, dear," said Nanny. She shrugged. "Well, Ella's got away, and so have we, and this is the part where we escape, yes? That's what we're supposed to do?"
None of them moved.
"They aren't very nice people in there," said Magrat after a while, "but they don't deserve alligators."
"You witches, stand right there," said a voice behind them.
Half a dozen guards were crowded around the hole in the wall.
"Life's certainly busier in the city," said Nanny, pulling another hatpin from her hat. "They've got crossbows," warned Magrat. "There's not much you can do against crossbows. Projectile weapons is lesson 7, and I haven't had that yet."
"They can't pull triggers if they think they've got flippers," said Granny, menacingly.
"Now," said Nanny, "let's not have any of that, eh? Everyone knows the good ones always win, especially when they're outnumbered."
The guards emerged. As they did so, a tall black shape dropped noiselessly from the wall behind them.
"There," said Nanny, "I said he wouldn't go far from his mummy, didn't I?"
One or two of the guards realized that she was staring proudly past them and turned. As far as they were concerned, they confronted a tall, broad-shouldered man with a mane of black hair, an eye patch, and a very wide grin. He stood with his arms casually folded. He waited until he had their full attention, and then Grebo let his lips part slowly. Several of the men took a step backwards then. One of them said,
"Why worry? It's not as if he's got a weapon."
Grebo raised one hand. Claws make no noise as they slide out, but they ought to. They ought to make a noise like tsing. Grebo's grin widened.
"Ah, these still worked."
One of the men was bright enough to raise his crossbow, but stupid enough to do it with Nanny Ogg standing behind him with a hatpin. Her hand moved so swiftly that any wisdom-seeking saffron-clad youth would have started the way of Mrs. Ogg there and then. The man screamed and dropped the bow.
"Row!"
Grebo leapt.